All right. Good morning, everybody. Welcome in. This is a Thursday. We're glad to have you listening to Christian Worldview with Tony and Hannah. I'm Tony Beam. I'm the Director of Church and Community Engagement for the Tim Brasher Campus of North Greenville University, where Christ makes a difference. My smirking co-host is Hannah Miller.
Outspokenly conservative and unashamedly smirking. This is Hannah Miller, informed and unafraid.
So what are you smirking about? So you were smirking. I wasn't smirking at you.
We started our Facebook live feed, and somebody posted on there that they loved the Fireflies story. LOL, take a class. So I was laughing about that because I know you're not a social media guy, but I posted about my daughter last night. She came running in the house, and she's like, "Mom!" And I was like, "Yes." And she goes, "You've got to help me. I'm catching fireflies, and this is serious business." And
wow.
So I went out, and I helped her, and then she's like, "Mom, you got to catch them very gently because they're so valuable." That's what she says, valuable. And she says, "I'm not kidding, Mom."
Yeah.
And then, you know, we kind of keep going on. And then she's like, "Mom, you're not being very careful. And I think that's why they're not coming to us. Just let me do this. I know everything about fireflies." I do, Mom.
Yeah. I bet she doesn't know this. If you do like I do and just smash them, you can paint their little glow stuff on your face. And then you can walk around and it looks like you're glowing in the night. But you have to smash them and paint the little glow stuff on your face.
Yeah.
So.
I'm not going to teach that one to her.
Yeah, you might want to tell her that. Just say, "Oh, my co-host, here, look, honey, you can smash him." Just smash him right in front of her. See what
she'll
said.
She'll be so disappointed in you.
Yes, she would be. All right, yesterday, CHOP came down. And what you need to know about that is that all these stories about it being just this nice little neighborhood, the summer of love, according to Mayor Durkin, the police had to go in, arrest a bunch of people, disarm some people, because the Summer of Love had turned into pretty much a militarized zone. But I want to go back as we talk about this, just because, you know, I know here in South Carolina, we hear this and we're like, why do you care? I care because I think it's important for you to understand fully the mindset of these progressives, where they're coming from. How little they think about what's actually happening and how willing they are to deny the obvious in favor of a narrative that is not going to be able to be sustained in the long run, because the facts are going to come out. Just like when you go in and start taking the barriers down and you retake the police precinct, all of a sudden these peaceful protesters that were cooking hot dogs and making the streets, as the Seattle Times said, smell like a July 4th celebration, which the Times really ought to be castigated because we're not supposed to celebrate July 4th this year, you know, because that's a bunch of angry white men that were slave owners that started the country. We've got to tear down that imagery, so we don't need to be out celebrating July 4th. I'll just tell you, I'll be celebrating July 4th. I'll be shooting off fireworks. I'll be eating hot dogs, hamburgers, things that are generally bad for me. And I've had my American flag outside my house for a week. I mean, I wanted to get started early on making sure that people knew where I was coming from. But in any event, you know, the Seattle Times likes to portray this, and they portrayed the whole CHOP zone as being a positive thing for protesters. And when the police got there to tear it down, it was a totally different story, since a bunch of people had to go to jail as they resisted. Now, Mayor Durkin was on with Chris Cuomo, and of course, everybody likes to highlight the fact that she referred to this as the Summer of Love. But she had a lot more to say than that. I mean, if you listen to the whole interview, and she's trying now to defend herself by saying, "Wait a minute, listen to the whole interview." So I took her advice. I thought, well, you know, let's give her the benefit of the doubt. It's possible that she's being quoted out of context and that people are using that against her. So I went back and listened, and I want you to hear just a little bit of it. This is not at the end of the interview. This is toward the middle when she's talking about CHOP and how it's been set up.
So I know it will shock you that the president is perhaps not giving an accurate or truthful picture, We've got four blocks in Seattle that you just saw pictures of that is more like a block party atmosphere. It's not an armed takeover. It's not a military junta. We will make sure that we can restore this, but we have block parties and the like in this part of Seattle all the time. It's known for that. So I think the president, number one, there is no threat right now to the public. And we're taking that very seriously. We're meeting with businesses and residents. But what the president threatened is illegal and unconstitutional.
Okay, what the president said is that if these mayors and governors don't go in and take control, then the federal government will. Of course, that never happened, and the mayors didn't take control. And with her saying that this is just a block party and no one is in danger, you have countless episodes of property damage. Now that the CHOP has been invaded and taken down, you had four shootings, two murders, people walking around handing out weapons. There was actually a video of one group that was handing out AR-15 rifles from the back of a pickup truck. I mean, it really did look like a military junta or something like Boko Haram would do. I mean, it was a very bad atmosphere. All of the press tried to downplay this and present it as the mayor said, just a summer of love, just a block party. These things happen all the time. When the people of the city, she went on to say later, when actually Chris Cuomo, to his credit, reacted sort of negatively to her summer of love comment. And he said, I don't think the police would agree with you. And she said, wait a minute, the police have been there meeting with these people. We're negotiating. The business leaders are on board. I mean, just a whole bunch of hooey coming out of the mayor of Seattle that has all proven to be completely false. When the police finally moved in and took the barriers down, and she had to declare it an unlawful assembly. See, she didn't want to do that. That was the end of it, because she declared it a summer of love, and then in the end she had to call it an unlawful assembly and have one of her council members investigated for pushing socialist policies, which if she's going to do that, I think they should look into her while they're investigating the council member. Mm-hmm.
No, I think one of the things we might see in a lot of these cities and areas like Seattle that are having issues is some corruption that gets exposed and some alliances that shouldn't have ever been had. And I mean, there's even, I think somebody on Facebook said that the police chief there really has been quoted as saying, we believe in the cause, and they've been in support of some of this going on. And I think that, you know, it may not become a national issue because there's so many of these. But in these areas, I really do hope that the people who have voted and put these, you know, the mayor and the police chief in office, wake up and say, no, you know what? We can't have this anymore. Will that happen? I don't know. But I'd like to think that it would. And that there's people who live in those districts, in those areas, who their businesses are getting burned to the ground. Their businesses are getting destroyed. They've been impacted so horribly by all of this that they would, you know, stop self-flagellating because they're white, and actually, you know, say, no, we need to vote differently next time.
Yeah, you would think.
But I don't know. You know, they've been trained to hate themselves and to hate the fact that they were born white, which they have absolutely no control over. And so maybe they just, you know what, if this is what I have to pay in reparations, so be it. I can see them going that route too.
Well, I don't think many people are going to consider the destruction of their private businesses as reparations. Yeah. I mean, because what is it, you know, when you stop and think about it, what does that do for anybody? It doesn't uplift
the African American
community. No, but this African
American expressing
community.
Yourself yeah, right. is what's important to this culture nowadays. Well, so this is giving them the freedom to express the anger and the angst that's been building for centuries.
One of the interesting things is Seattle Times talked about the free speech zone within CHOP where people could go stand and say anything they wanted to for like a few minutes. Mm-hmm. So this is what's interesting is that the entire country is supposed to be a free speech zone. But when you have a bunch of anarchists and Marxists who take over, then they get to designate where you can actually speak, which by definition makes it not a free speech zone. Because you're being forced by a third party to stand there in order to say what's on your mind.
But see, they've been at universities all across this country, this right. age group, that right. have those exact things.
Oh, yeah.
There are campus, college campuses across the country who that have free speech zones where this, if you want to say whatever you want to say, this is the area where you have to go to, like you just said, which is by definition means it's not free speech. And they've just set up, they're just repeating what they see on the college campuses.
Washington Times columnist Tim Young was talking about the fact that the Seattle Times said the guarded area that was actually being guarded by people with semi-automatic weapons and by a person who referred to himself as a warlord. And yet the Seattle Times was saying that this was a fun time where most of the protesters inside, not anarchists, not rioters, most of the protesters inside were handing out free snacks. And Tim Young, to me, had the best line about this when he told Fox News, that's as insane as saying Boko Haram was just starting a dating service when they kidnapped nearly 300 women in Nigeria a few years ago. Yeah, and that is, I mean, if you'd have said that about Boko Haram, these girls that were kidnapped to be raped, that would be like saying that that's a dating service when you're comparing it to what actually took place in CHOP. So hopefully, I keep reporting these things, because I just feel the need for the American people to wake up to this. Wake up and see what's going on. This is anarchy. This is chaos. This is what progressives want, because they want the entire system that we live under to be torn down so they can replace it with their view of utopia, which is Marxist and socialist driven. Chris on Facebook today celebrating Confederate monuments coming down, ignoring the fact that fellow progressives like Chris are tearing down monuments to true American heroes all across the country because they want to destroy the system. And it's interesting that he continues to refer to Comrade Trump when it's the work of progressives in erasing history. You know, that's one of the first things that communists do. When they come in, when they take over, they rewrite history. They take down all of the symbols of previous history, whether good or bad, whether you consider them symbols of something that was good or symbols that were something bad, of something bad. They take down all of the symbols in order to rewrite and undermine the existing history with the history that they want to write over it. And here, you know, here's someone that is celebrating the move of true socialism and communism, Marxism, referring to the president as comrade. And that just, to me, that's just a perfect illustration of where progressives are today. And they have to know what they're doing. I mean, you know, chanting USA, USA, while people are violating or breaking the law, tearing down the history of the United States so that they can rewrite it. That's a really interesting thing.
The Statue of Columbus was taken down in Columbus, Ohio, yesterday morning.
Well, they're going to continue. This is going to keep going.
Going after Abraham Lincoln.
Well, yeah, The New York Times yesterday started laying out the case for taking down Mount Rushmore. I mean, I'm telling you, this is going to become a huge movement. And if Biden gets elected and progressives take the Senate, then maybe they do blow up Mount Rushmore. I mean, maybe we see it covered. I mean, some kind of huge covering until we can figure out how to actually bring it down. I wouldn't doubt that, because again, that is that when you define anti-racism as, you know, in other words, if you're personally not a racist, if your life exudes an example of what it means to treat everybody equitably, that's not enough unless you're an anti-racist. And there's a great piece today. I think it would be good to, we'll go ahead and take a look at it since we started down this road. It talks about what anti-racism really is and how it's a big problem. It was written, I want to thank Ben Shapiro, because this is one of those thought pieces that Shapiro is pretty famous for. But the difference between being against racism and being anti-racist, Ibram Kendi, author of How to Be an Anti-Racist, provides the answer. Racism is no longer to be defined as the belief that someone is inferior based on race. Instead, racism is to be defined as the belief that any group differences can be attributed to anything other than racism. So in other words, if there's any discrepancy between racial groups, it's racism. No matter whether it's really racism in terms of an attitude or a thought process, if there's a discrepancy, it's racism. So now if you now you can begin to understand when you look at, for example, the prison system, and you see, let's say that African American males are incarcerated at a higher rate percentage-wise based on the percentage of the population that's African American males.
Yeah, 33% of those incarcerated right now in the United States are African American.
Are African American? Okay.
When they're only 12% of the population.
12%. Okay, there you go. So there's a disparity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got a distance between the minority represented and the minority that's actually incarcerated. So that's racism no matter what. Doesn't matter what the people did to get there. Doesn't matter if they were guilty of their crimes. Doesn't matter if crime is a problem in a lot of these inner city neighborhoods that are populated heavily by African Americans. It does, and none of that matters. If there's any disparity, then that's systematic racism. And so let me read the rest of this real quick, and then we'll talk about it. Racism is defined as belief any group differences can be attributed to anything other than racism. Thus, any system that ends with different outcomes must be racist. Indeed, Kendi contends, racism itself is institutional, structural, and systemic. So to be anti-racist means to tear down these systems. Any obstacle in the pursuit of equality of outcomes must be torn down, assumed to be a product of discrimination. So if there's outcomes, if you put, I'm just going to make something up here. If you put 10 white people and 10 black people in an education system and 8 of the 10 white people graduate and 6 of the 10 black people graduate, it's not because of anything to do with the individuals. It is systemic institutional racism that's holding back. So there's no personal responsibility or accountability possible if you're going to be anti-racist.
Mm-hmm. Well, to follow up that number about incarceration rates, what we have to actually appropriately do to get to understand those statistics is not look at the broad population of the United States, but you have to look at the criminal population. And 33%, having African Americans populate 33% of our prison system, well, that's about where they're at with the criminal population, with the criminal community, is about 33% to 37%, and with the crimes committed. And so they're right on target with, okay, if you do the crime, you do the time. That's what we believe in the United States. Well, they're committing a disproportionate amount of crimes in the United States per their demographic, their
right.
population, the percentage
right.
population in the United States. That's why. So it's right in line with those numbers. Another aspect of this that you hear all of the time is that I think it's for the percentage of African Americans that are in poverty versus white Americans. And I think it's over 20% of African Americans are in poverty, whereas it's only 11% of whites are in poverty. And they say, oh, it's more than double, or it's about double. And they kind of get into that and they talk about it. Well, if you actually remove single parent households from those numbers, African Americans and whites right on track. They're making the same amount. When you remove single parent homes from both sides, and you look at those just two parent homes from blacks and whites, they're tracking right together. But what people don't want to talk about is the fact that 67% of homes in the African American community are single parent homes. And
yeah.
It's the number one indicator that you're not going to graduate high school, that you're going to fall into crime, that you're going to have a child out of wedlock,
and that you're going to be in poverty.
Those are the things that, you know, actually Thomas Sowell had an interview just yesterday or the day before, and he talked about that very thing. Right there, he said, there's no systemic racism. It's the culture choices that we're making
right.
that force us into. Because one of the things I see frequently is for every $100 that a white person owns, the African-American community only has like $5.04 or something like that. And talking about it's systemic. It's all about the system. And Ben Shapiro does a great video as well. And I loved it because he took this video that I've seen a lot of my friends share. And they just swallow it wholesale. It's about how it's about redlining and about how all of these things you've kind of mentioned already, the education system, incarceration rates, poverty, and how they're systemic. He broke all of it down. He played the video piece by piece and would stop it and respond to each of the different points. And I love the way he kind of parsed it out, clearly communicated, and why some of the questions that we need to ask about what they're trying to present. And you need to go find it on YouTube if this is an interesting topic to you. And I think that this so perfectly, I had not seen this article by Ben Shapiro, perfectly complements what he does in that video to expose how so many, especially young people, are just being lied to about all this information.
Well, and that's why so many young people are buying into this with you know, this young lady. Go back and talk about the soccer team for a minute. The young lady who stood with her hand over her heart.
We talked about it, I think, off air yesterday.
Yeah. She, well, there was a soccer team. It was, I think, some from Chicago, maybe. Anyway, they were to play the national anthem. Every girl on the soccer team knelt for the national anthem except one who stood with her hand over her heart. Now, before you get all, you know, weepy-eyed about it, I mean, she apologized for standing. She said that she was in solidarity with her peers and her teammates, that we have systemic racism and that we have a race and all of this.
She's
the reason she stood,
BLM.
She full supporter of Black Lives Matter movement, not Black Lives Matter, but the Black Lives Matter movement, which is a big difference. She's in support of all of that. It's just that her family is a military family, and they fought for the country, and she felt like she couldn't betray them by kneeling to the flag and in front of the flag. And what was interesting to me about all of that is that the pressure that was put on her, the fact that we're having this discussion, I mean, just stand back for a second and realize that the person that's being ostracized here is the one who's trying to pay respect to the United States, to the country, trying to say that we're fortunate and blessed to live in a free country, a constitutional republic, a country that's done more for the rest of the world than any country in history. And yet to do that makes you the person that gets singled out. We've absolutely flipped our value system in just a very short period of time, so that support of the country has to be you've got to apologize for it. You've got to have six reasons why that you're still with the ones that are kneeling, and it's just really sad. Where if you would just do the research, and that's why we're talking about this. That's why it's important for you to understand these statements about systemic racism and the entire country is racist and every policeman is walking around looking to kill a black male, that's all lies. It's fabricated. It's a made-up narrative to get you to buy into the wholesale destruction of our institutions so that they can be replaced with the anarchist and Marxist vision of America. Please understand that. That's not hyperbole. It's not overstatement. It's not panic. I'm just telling you that this is what's going on. And when all you have to do is take 5 minutes and look under the surface. And if you're 30 years old or younger, stop eating all of this stuff off of Facebook. Stop taking social media as if it's the tablets coming down from Mount Sinai, and do just a little bit of due diligence and look inside the meaning of the numbers and stop marching against your own country to see it replaced by some kind of Marxist socialist regime. I mean, that is what we are about to do here. Okay. I feel better now. I'll drink some more coffee. Back to the Daily Signal and Ben Shapiro's piece as we continue this conversation. Shapiro says anti-racism in its essence is merely reworked neo-Marxism from the 1960s. Now, in the 1960s, Robert Marcuse, who was a major contributor and pusher of neo-Marxism and neo-Marxism philosophy in the 60s, he tried to push neo-Marxism from this idea of repressive tolerance, which repressive tolerance is that you tolerate everything coming from the left and you repress anything, any thought that comes from the right, and you do it in the name of class warfare. So Marcuse's arguments were all based around the haves and the have-nots trying to drive a class warfare wedge in to guilt people who had money into believing that they had to give up all their money, all their resources, in order that everybody equally could share, as if there's some kind of equal right in a country that's based on capitalism. So, and we do have an equal right. Everybody's got the same right to succeed. Everybody's got the right to go as far as their gifts and abilities will take them. But what you got to do is convince people that that's not true. Well, now that argument has been shifted from social wealth warfare to racial warfare. So, in other words, and this is something that's captured, that's sticking. In other words, the class warfare arguments of the 1960s didn't broadly bring people into the Marxist movement. The racist argument shifting over and taking Marxism and equating and sort of putting it in under the rubric of racism is sticking. And it's like Hannah and I were talking about, and she was telling me during the break, that a lot of people her age that are strong Christians, that, you
they're
know,
intelligent human intelligent beings, people who educated. Treat,
you know, all of that, that they're buying into Marxism when they think that what they're really doing is putting is putting away racism. They're willing to buy this argument and to give up on our institutions and to hate America based on racism when they wouldn't do it based on class warfare. So this represents a major step forward for Marxism. Barry's on the phone. Let's talk to him. Go ahead, Barry.
Hey, Tony. I agree with Thomas Sowell and Larry Elder and what have you about the black people, with the way the government has programs set up, that they're able to really do well and get into the middle class or upper middle class. I got a couple of questions, and I want to tell you a scenario that happened about 35 years ago when I was working for a bus company in Boston, for the city of Boston. Are you, can you give me a quick example of what white privilege, like a white privilege example? Just curious.
I don't know.
The
Hannah,
example, yeah, the example that they give in the video that I was talking about is white privilege is the fact that a white young boy who goes to the same school that the other, or a white boy in his neighborhood, he's raised in a certain neighborhood, and a black boy is raised in a certain neighborhood. The white boy can go to a school, and because of his name, even if they have the exact same resume, went to the same schools or went to similar schools or have all of the same numbers on their grades, because of his name, he's going to get into a school, and the black boy will be passed over. That's just one simple example.
Yeah, but that one's not even accurate. Even Thomas Sowell, and then we'll tell you that the affirmative action and stuff like that, black people can, you know, get in as well. But here's an example I was going to tell you, Tony. I worked for this company that we transported handicapped children busing in the city of Boston. And so the bus company, it was a very competitive situation as far as getting contracts. You get contracts from the federal government, the state, and so... I was very competitive. So what we did as a company, and we put a black person on the board, a black woman on the board of the company. So being a white person, I took advantage of black privilege, put the black person on the board of the company, and guess who got a bunch of federal government grants, and we profited quite well. So should I have to repent for taking advantage of black privilege? I mean, I know if I asked Dan Cathy, I'd be shining shoes for eternity.
Yeah, okay, I see what you're saying. So in other words, because you made the decision to incorporate an African-American woman on the board, that opened up federal dollars to flow into your company. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly right. It happened exactly right. We did very well. We got plenty of grant money because we, I was woke before woke was woke. That was 35 years ago.
Yeah,
because it was a double. Well, it was a double intersect, woman and being black. So, I guess being white, taking advantage of black privilege, should I have to repent of that?
Well, that's an interesting way to put it, Barry. I mean, it's an interesting way to think about it if you think about advantages that were afforded people, and I have no idea if that's still the case, that if companies
it's absolutely minority, sure, no, that's exactly the case. That was 35 years ago, Tony. And I profited from that. So didn't the person that went on the board. But the government has the system set up like that. I was just following what the government system, the government set up.
Yeah. Okay, Barry, thanks. I appreciate the call.
Get out of here.
I don't know. I mean, I see the thought process here that actually because of affirmative action and because of government processes that were put in place to support affirmative action, that there was advantage to the advantage actually shifted to African Americans who once were included in order to take advantage of these programs. Was that a privilege that they were granted that then people that were white took advantage of because they exploited the system? Now, that would be terrible. I mean, what you would hope to see is that you look at every person based on their merit, and that you put people on a board because of the gifts and abilities that they have and their ability to bring something to the board to make it better. That's the way it should. That's the way it should work. And the other thing about this that makes it a little really skewed, you know, if because the argument against the quota system, so to speak, has been people who have argued against it have said that it undermines the actual creativity and contributions of African Americans and Asians and Hispanics because it suggests that they can't make it unless there's an affirmative action program. In other words, we have to take because they can't, they're not able. And of course, the counter argument is, well, they are able, but they're being discriminated against because of their minority status. But what affirmative action did, if you look in a lot of these situations, then standards had to be adjusted. And I'm not talking about because of race, but because of if you go back and the things you have to connect all the dots together to understand it, you go back to the single parent neighborhoods, you go back to the opportunities that were afforded people, not because of color, but because of the culture of their neighborhood that held back, the fact that there was no father in the home, mm-hmm. the fact that a lot of minorities lived in Democrat controls environments where they had inner cities with high crime rates and high poverty rates that did not afford them the same opportunities that other people had. But was that because of race, or was it because of government policies and the lack of a father being in the home? I think you can make the case for the latter.
Mm-hmm. What we really have in the United States, I've been wrestling with this over the last couple of weeks as I've been looking into all of this, is what we really have in the United States is economic privilege. And we actually believe in that if you work really hard for something,
right,
you should get the privileges, the economic privilege that comes with it. And you know what? I firmly believe that if your grandparents worked really hard for something and you inherited it, that's yours as well, because that's how family ties, inheritance. If they worked hard for it and they want to give it to their children and their children maintain it and keep it and then want to give it to you, that's within your rights. And I fully support that economic privilege. But when you parse down the differences and the disparities within across the demographics that come with when you're looking at the different races, one of the things that you talked about here in this article with Ben Shapiro, any kind of when there's different outcomes, it always has to be race. When you look at the different outcomes amongst the different demographics, amongst the different races, you almost always get down to economic differences.
Yeah.
And it's, well, why are there economic differences?
That's
the question.
That's what I was trying to say.
What my generation is being taught to believe is that there are economic differences between the races because of the institutions, because of the system. Well, here's my contention. The system doesn't work without people. Banks right. not giving an African American a loan, that doesn't just happen. There has to be a person willing to follow through with the system and not give a loan to an African American. You can have bad laws on the books every day of the week, which we do. In the state of South Carolina, it's still legal to beat your wife as long as you do it on Sundays of the court steps of your city. So, well, nobody, that's a bad law. That's a bad system that's out there. Nobody's going to people aren't going to follow through with it. You have to have people who would actually be racist to follow through with that. And so they're trying to convince you, well, it's not necessarily, I mean, they say everybody is racist, but they're narrowing it into the system right now because that's what they have to tear down, because that's what Marxists do.
Yeah.
But like I said, it doesn't work if the people aren't racist. And that's why you have to look around. And one of the questions I like to ask people is, do you believe that we're more racist as a country now than in the 1960s? Well, nobody in their right mind is going to say, yes, we're more racist now than we were in the 1960s. Well, then why are African Americans doing worse now than they were in the 1960s? If racism is the issue, and institutionalized racism. But see, problem is
I can answer that question.
Yeah,
Great Society started in the 1960s that essentially dismantled and destroyed the nuclear family in African-American
That's
communities.
That's exactly right.
And I mean, when that happened, then opportunity went out the window as well. Now, does that mean that there aren't racists? You know, we always feel like we have to come back to this statement. No one is saying that there aren't people who are prejudiced or racist in America today. No one is saying that they're not out there as part of the institutions. What we're saying is the institutions themselves are not populated by majority racist that intentionally manipulate those institutions to keep one race down. That would be racism. But nobody wants to take any personal responsibility for anything, so we have to blame something. And for Marxism to work, it has to be the system, because the system has to be torn down. Let me recommend a book that I just think everybody ought to be in everybody's library. It's by Larry Schweikert, and the title is 48 Liberal Lies About American History. This is a great resource. Because a lot of these things, for example, the statement was made on Facebook that if the Confederacy had won the war, but in the Civil War, then slavery would have been perpetuated and
would still be having
slavery. That's a complete misreading and misunderstanding of history. There would have been a lot of consequences if the Confederacy had won the war that would have been negative. But the perpetuation of slavery was on its way out economically before the Civil War. Now, the South was making a last gasp because they refused to see that the industrial age was going to render slavery absolutely an economic boondoggle for them. Now, that's a terrible thing. I mean, that obviously people should have realized that slavery was immoral, not just economically unfeasible. So please don't misunderstand me. I'm not defending slavery by saying that the only reason that it would have went away would have been economics. I'm just making the point that the Civil War was about a lot of things. Slavery was the main thing, in my view. But it was also about a lot of other things, like states' rights, like a process of living that came under fire, different cultural differences between regions of an incredibly large country. And it's a good thing that the North won. Don't get me. I'm not saying I want the South to do it again. I'm not calling for a resurgence of the Confederacy. It was the best for the United States that the South was defeated, that slavery came to an end abruptly rather than coming to an end gradually. But my point is that it's just historic. It's a historic fallacy to suggest that we would still have slave trading going on today if the South had won the war. That's just not factually correct. And a lot of things like this are perpetuated by progressives to try to win an argument. And this book is just 48 liberal lies that liberals tell about American history. I mean, it's just, I'll give you just a few. Lie number one, the first presidents intended for the United States to be isolationist. I'm just going to pick a few here. Let's see. The peace movement activists were not dupes of the KGB. Ronald Reagan knew Star Wars wouldn't work, but wanted to provoke an arms race. Mikhail Gorbachev, not Ronald Reagan, was responsible for ending the Cold War. The founders envisioned a wall of separation between church and state. On and on. No, women had no rights in early America. So you go on. There are these things that we hear all the time. And, of course, Columbus is on here, that Columbus infected the Native Americans and led to their death, and he's guilty of genocide and blah, blah, blah. You really need to have this book. And then when these things come up, you can go back and
as a resource.
Being a conservative, you can go back and look at the facts and actually win an argument. Well, you're not going to win an argument with a progressive based on facts.
No. Well, but the problem here is the fact that and Chris did it in the comment section, and he's like, that's revisionist history. Every time, look, you can put a photo in front of them and they say, oh, it's just photoshopped, or here's a video. Okay, here's a video. Oh, you just recreated. That's probably from a movie somewhere.
Right.
I mean, we don't believe anything anymore,
right,
at all whatsoever. The only person we find reliable is ourselves and our feeling, my personal feelings on the matter, what I believe. Everything else is revisionist. Everything else is just fake. It's all lies. And nobody trusts anybody or anything anymore.
Yeah, and if I can just boil all that down for you, we're worshiping the creation rather than the creator. And again, worshiping the creation includes self-worship. It includes being enamored with our own ideas, and to the point that we're willing to make godlike pronouncements over everybody else. And you find, I mean, this is happening with progressives. If you don't say anything, silence is violence. If you do say something, well, you didn't say enough. You have to say what we tell you to say the way we tell you to say it. And then we'll still have a meeting to decide whether you're going to be part of the progressive club. I mean, this is the kind of nonsense that is holding sway right now in this country. And let me just be clear about this, because I think some people doubt it. This will destroy the country. Mm-hmm. Don't get me wrong. This is not just going to make America a more difficult place to live. Ultimately, you get chopped when you embrace progressive ideology, and it leads
Venezuela.
And it leads to total destruction in the end. Hear me on this.